This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/radio3.
In this podcast edition of the essay, Professor Anthony Grayling discusses Wagner and the philosophy of revolution.
Richard Wagner stood alongside Mikhail Bakunin on the barricades in Dresden in May 1849, one of the culminating events of the revolutionary movement known as the Springtime of the Peoples that rocked the social and political structure of Europe in the mid-19th century. After the failure of the uprising, when Wagner was in self-imposed exile in Switzerland, his fellow revolutionaries accused him of having not been serious politically, saying that in reality he was only interested in making society right for the reception of his music. In the autobiography he wrote many years later, when he had royal patronage to consider and a more respectable persona to project, Wagner adopted this as the full and true explanation of his motivations at the time. But, as is always the case, the truth was more complicated than that. In the years before and after the revolutionary events of 1848-9, Wagner was indeed enthusiastically committed to the idea that society needed wholesale reform and democratization. We are told as much by his actions, his writings, and the Ring Cycle itself, which he conceived in the autumn of 1848 in Vienna, where he had come under the influence of Ludwig Feuerbach and Pierre-Jean Proudhon. Indeed, in the months leading up to the Dresden Uprising of May 1849, Wagner became increasingly radical, publicly calling for the King of Saxony to abdicate and for the Saxon army to join the insurgents on the barricades. When the uprising failed, he escaped arrest and made his way to Switzerland, where, in 1849, he published Art and Revolution, in 1850, The Work of Art of the Future, and in 1851, Opera and Drama, where he began work on the Ring Cycle, which on one interpretation rests squarely on a utopian socialist premise about the conflict between humanity and the distorting power of gold. The titles of Wagner's works in exile do indeed bear up the claims of his contemporaries, which he later accepted in full, that his revolutionary ardour was aimed at changing the world so that his conception of the complete artwork could be realised. This is, however, consistent with the ideal of remaking society and its institutions along utopian socialist lines. There's not only no inconsistency in this, but in Wagner's view, the very future of progress in art depended on it. The strong outlines of Wagner's revolutionary socialist principles in the years on either side of Dresden are clear in the articles he wrote. In Art and Revolution, he decried the annexation of art by commerce and the downgrading effect on it of labour, in which people, going wearily from work to the theatre, desire only entertainment. In The Work of Art of the Future, dedicated to Feuerbach, he wrote of the people's collective desire for art that will fill the void of longing they namelessly feel, and which they are denied because true art is usurped by entertainment, appealing to the basest and laziest tastes only, trading on bloated sentiment and sensation, interested only in producing effects rather than conveying philosophical profundity. The longest of Wagner's writings, apart from his autobiography, is Opera and Drama. In the two earlier works, he had described what kind of artwork is required for the ideal society. Now he explored in more detail that kind of artwork, especially in the relationship of poetry and music, if they are to achieve dramatic completeness. Much of the impetus for the Springtime of the Peoples in 1848 was for liberal reform rather than socialist reconstruction of society, which was the objective Wagner shared with those who most influenced him. Greater political freedom and participation, including increased civil liberties and freedom from censorship, and the replacement of authoritarian and aristocratic rule by democratic institutions, were the principal desires of the educated middle classes who engaged in the Springtime movements around Europe. They also desired unification of the German states, reflecting a matured national consciousness that wanted more than the Confederation, which had replaced the Holy Roman Empire destroyed by Napoleon a generation before. The working classes were far more radical in their aims, and in various parts of the German-speaking world, their activism resulted in bloody and too often fatal clashes with police and the military. This split the revolution, making it easier for the authorities in the various German states eventually to suppress it, though not without having been given a serious fright in the process, which led to varying degrees of reform, and finally to German unification in the decades following. The influences on Wagner that made him a revolutionary were diverse. Ludwig Feuerbach's attacks on religious orthodoxy were one such. The political and economic theories of Proudhon were another. His association with the professional anarchist Bakunin didn't make Wagner himself an anarchist. Rather, his idea of the people, who longed for works of art that satisfied and completed them, resonates with Proudhon's idea that the best form of socio-economic organization is the workers' cooperative or collective. Behind these figures were earlier and less well-known men, the people who made up the Left Hegelian or Young Hegelian group, active in the decade or so after Hegel's death in 1831, and who therefore were the influences in their turn of the revolutionaries of the late 1840s. They were inspired by Hegel's view that freedom and reason are the forces that direct history along its currents, and that the spirit whose unfolding is the stuff of history itself will conquer everything that is opposed not just to it, but to freedom and reason too. These heady convictions were coupled with their disagreement with the right or old Hegelians, who thought that Hegel had taught that the unfolding of history had come to an end. The young Hegelians saw that the dialectic of history was incomplete, that there was more to come, as proved by the continuation of irrationalities like religious belief and the lack of social and political freedom, a fact manifested by the authoritarian Prussian state. Wagner's own experience of revolutionary activism occurred in Saxony, where the events of 1848 elsewhere in Europe led to calls for a constitution with a free press, jury trial, and a parliament. Standard liberal demands, and hardly revolutionary, except from the point of view of traditional monarchy. These aspirations weren't quite enough for Wagner. He joined with the conductor and journalist Ernst Roeckel in signing up for a revolutionary association known as the Fatherland Union, and gave a lecture to it, urging closer links between art, especially the theatre, and the people. He'd already formed the view that unreformed society stood in the way of such links, and that partial or piecemeal reformation wouldn't be enough. Nothing but a sweeping away of the old order would do. It was for that reason that he found himself on the barricades in the early days of May 1849. There might not have been barricades if the more moderate demands for liberal reform had been met by the rulers of the German states. The King of Prussia was offered the crown of unified Germany, but refused. The King of Saxony dissolved the Saxon Diet and wouldn't talk with the reformers. It was this intransigence that brought moderates as well as the more militant revolutionaries onto the streets. They'd been joined by professional itinerant revolutionaries like Bakunin, but even so, they were fewer in number than the Prussian troops that the Saxon king was able to call to his aid. 3,000 untrained amateurs against 5,000 professional soldiers, in round numbers, so it wasn't surprising that the insurgency failed, and the revolutionaries either fled or surrendered, leaving about 200 of their number dead. 10 soldiers also died. Wagner was among those who fled, first to Chemnitz and then to Zurich in Switzerland, where he began what effectively proved to be, in total, a 12-year exile from Germany. Roeckel and Bakunin were arrested in Chemnitz. Wagner had completed Lohengrin just before the Dresden events and was able to persuade Liszt to have it staged in Weimar. But the earnings from it were small, and being cut off from a regular income, apart from a small pension that a well-wisher gave him, together with marital difficulties and a complicated love affair, at first made it difficult for him to concentrate on musical composition. In its place, he wrote prose. The works on art and the future, already mentioned, were the principal outcomes. It was at this time that he also wrote the first recognisably anti-Semitic work, Judaism in Music, in which he claimed that because Jews possess nothing of the true German spirit, they can only produce music that is shallow and insignificant. His creative urge couldn't be silenced for too long. The ideas he had formulated in the autumn before the Dresden Uprising started to bear fruit. He had then written a libretto entitled Siegfried's Death, and now added what we now call a prequel, Young Siegfried. Before 1852 was out, he had written the texts for the Valkyrie and Rheingold, and revised the earlier works to conform to them. Because the new works broke so decisively with the operas he had already composed, he needed to explain the departure and the concepts in which it was based. This he did in an essay entitled A Communication to My Friends, stating he was no longer a composer of operas, but instead of dramas, and that he proposed to produce his three connected full-length dramas, together with their prelude, in an evening and three successive days, making an overall work of mighty proportions. Political revolution might have failed. Artistic revolution was about to be launched. But there was another revolution to come. Wagner wrote the music for the Valkyrie and Rheingold in the years from 1853 to 1856, but the work was interrupted by a new departure and another dramatic turn in Wagner's thinking, his discovery of the philosophy of Schopenhauer, coinciding with his writing of Tristan and Isolde. He was introduced to Schopenhauer's world as will and representation by his friend the poet Georg Herve in 1854, and it did two things. First, it altered his ideas about the place of music in supreme art, and secondly, it swept away his views about society and human nature, substituting a more pessimistic vision that accorded with his own bleaker domestic sentiments and with his disappointments over reform and revolution. The Wagner we now think of as Wagner is the Wagner of the Schopenhauer years, not the Wagner of the Dresden barricades. This leaves us with the interesting question of which Wagner wrote The Ring, as we now have it. Is it the Wagner who wished to reform society, who saw the residual structures of feudalism in the political order and capitalism in the economic order as interfering with the relationship that people can have to art? Or is it the Schopenhauerian Wagner, far less optimistic, no longer interested in remaking society so that a complete art can flourish in it? Wagner said of his encounter with Schopenhauer's ideas that it was the single most important event of his life. This is a large claim, and if taken at face value, must mean that the finished Ring cycle belongs to the Schopenhauerian Wagner, in at least the sense that we can't attribute too much in the way of definite traces of the optimistic progressive revolutionary Wagner to it. At any distance from the creation of great works of art, it's easy to think that, in themselves, they are means of liberation for anyone who is receptive to them. Liberation of the heart and mind, of the sentiments, of thought. Liberation from the mundane and the pedestrian. Liberation into worlds of feeling or imagination more copious and enlarged than ordinary experience can ever provide. Wagner's idea of the complete artwork that answers our human need for such experience was at least part, and perhaps the most important part, of his impulse to be a revolutionary in the first place. It underlies his Mounting the Barricades and his revolutionary writings of the first period of exile. I think it survives the dramatic change of orientation that made him abandon the idea of social and political revolution and to take up the philosophical revolution of Schopenhauer instead. For if there is one theme that definitely links the Wagner of the Barricades with the Wagner of the later works, it's the idea of the expansive and, as it were, holistic experience of art as complete artwork, and of its necessity to the human spirit.